I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, my guest for the hour is Senator Chris Van Hollen. Maryland's junior senator serves on the Senate Budget Committee as well as the Banking and Environment Committees and the all-important Appropriations Committee. We'll talk about national security in the wake of President Trump's dismissal last week of threat assessments by his intelligence chiefs, to the Senate's rebuke of Mr. Trump's decision to attenuate the American military presence in Afghanistan and Syria. The senator has introduced a bill designed to shed light on fundraising conflicts of interest among presidential appointees, and he's reached across the aisle to work with Republicans to address foreign influence in elections and to work on criminal justice reform, passing the First Step Act. Senator Chris Van Hollen joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, it's a conversation with Senator Chris Van Hollen. He was elected to the Senate in 2016. After serving seven terms in the House of Representatives, he serves on the Senate Budget Committee, as well as the Banking and Environment Committees and the all-important Appropriations Committee. He's also the former chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. A little later in the program, we'll take your calls and comments. We are also streaming live today on the WIPR Facebook page, and you can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. Senator, good to see you, sir.
It's good to be back, Tom.
So I wonder if the Senate can pass a resolution requiring the NFL to have better games for Super Bowls. You think? Because it seems to me there's been an awful lot of bipartisan support for that.
We were just talking before we started here, and both agreed that it was quite a snoozer. The lowest scoring game in NFL history is not one that gets you out of your seat. But in any event.
I also thought it was an incredible comment on the body politic where, at least in my estimation, the best ad was the ad for the Washington Post defending a free press. I mean, it shows where we are, you know, and it's a very precarious place.
It was. So we need light, more light and less darkness.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some foreign matters in particular. The president on Friday announced, or Secretary Pompeo, the Secretary of State, announced that the U.S. is withdrawing from the INF treaty. This is the intermediate nuclear treaty. There is still a long-range nuclear treaty that remains in effect. But we have scrapped the INF treaty. Russia announced soon thereafter that they, too, would leave that agreement and begin putatively buffering up their nuclear arsenal. Where do we stand with this?
This was a big mistake. It was a mistake from the point of view of American security and the security of our NATO allies. There are definitely some issues we need to resolve in the Russian program with the intermediate nuclear range missiles. But pulling out entirely and allowing Russia to be able to pull out immediately thereafter is actually going to hurt our interests. This is something I was involved in way back in the 1980s. Long before I thought of running for office myself. I first worked for Senator Mac Mathias from Maryland. He was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And when he retired, I went to work on the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I worked on the INF Treaty ratification.
This is 1987.
It was 1987 it was signed, and then I believe ratified in 88. And President Reagan, of course, negotiated the agreement, he and his team. And the reason it is bad for U.S. security for us to withdraw is just think about geography, right? The Russians have this huge landmass that borders on Europe and on in East Asia. And so they can deploy intermediate range missiles on their territory. The United States has sea-based missiles. We have air-based missiles. But in order for us to deploy ground-based missiles, we have to get our allies to welcome them. And the whole reason we have the INF Treaty to begin with was, if you think way back, the Russians deployed what was called the SS-20. It was aimed at Europe. And the United States and our allies pushed very hard for the United States to respond in kind by deploying what was called the Pershing 2 missile. It created huge protests in Europe. And the result was they withdrew their SS-20, intermediate range nuclear missiles. We withdrew Pershing 2, and that was part of the agreement. So when you tear up that agreement, it allows Russia to just proliferate intermediate-range nuclear missiles across a very large landmass. And it puts us at a big disadvantage. This was a stupid move from the perspective of U.S. national security.
And, of course, at the time the treaty was proposed and ratified, Mr. Reagan famously said that the overarching approach was trust but verify. Secretary Pompeo is basically saying that Russia has not been living up to their part of the bargain in this treaty, and that that's the one of the reasons he gave for withdrawing.
Yes, I think that the Russians dispute that. I agree with Secretary Pompeo's analysis on this. If you look at one of the missiles they deployed, it looks like it could reach the ranges that are limited under the treaty. The Russians have a different rationale, but the issue is what's the best response? And the best response is to work with the Russians to get them to be transparent and change their conduct with respect to some of these missiles that have been deployed. Ripping up the entire agreement at this point just gives them a green light to really ramp up their intermediate range land-based missiles. And it was, you know, 24 hours after we made our statement that they withdrew as well. They had, and so when it comes to this new, what I really worry about, a new arms race when it comes to nuclear weapons in general, but specifically in this category. And they have this big geographic advantage that I just mentioned.
On Thursday, the Senate, including 43 Republicans, passed a bill proposed by Leader McConnell to rebuke Mr. Trump's plan to withdraw forces from Syria and Afghanistan. You and Mr. Cardin both voted against the resolution. But it was surprising to a lot of people that so many Republicans, I think there were 43 who voted for the resolution, to really express displeasure at the president's decision to attenuate our military presence in both of those places.
Well, let me make it clear, and I believe this is Senator Cardin's view as well. I think the way the president announced the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria was reckless. He did it over Twitter, and more importantly, he did it without any plan. And you need to make sure that we finish the job against ISIS. We know the president keeps saying that he's totally demolished ISIS, but we also heard from his top intelligence officials the other day, that's just not the case. You still have ISIS physically present in parts of Syria. They've been badly eroded, but they're still there, and we need to finish the job. We also need to make sure that the Syrian Kurds, who have been the primary fighting force with the United States against ISIS, do not become the victims of a Turkish attack. Turkey, which of course borders on Syria, has always had as its priority not going after ISIS, but actually going after the Kurds. And we need to make sure that the Kurds, Syrian Kurds, do not become victims in this process. So I think the way that President Trump has gone about this is entirely wrong. I think the way he announced the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, again, wrong. But that resolution contains some language that I believe could be interpreted to allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in Syria and in Afghanistan. It included a couple clauses that would have made it very difficult for any president to certify that it was time for U.S. forces to leave. And I am not in favor of perpetual war in Afghanistan. I'm not in favor of perpetual U.S. troop presence in Syria.
So that
was the reason for opposing that particular resolution in that form.
And what are you looking for then in order to justify finally eventually pulling out of, you know, the longest war in American history in Afghanistan, as well as this war in Syria that clearly seems to have shifted the momentum, and the advantage at the moment seems to be with Bashar al-Assad. A couple of years ago, people were talking about, it's days and weeks before he's removed from power, and he has clung to power quite tenaciously, and right now it looks like he's winning.
Well, there's no doubt that Assad is in the stronger military position as of right now. Our main goal, and at least from my perspective, our main goal in Syria has been eliminating ISIS and then doing what we can to establish a sort of political settlement to the tragedy in Syria. And that means finishing the job against ISIS. And again, there are just some remnants. They're along the Euphrates River. I think we can address those. We also need a plan. Maybe it's international forces along that Turkish-Syria border to make sure that you have a humanitarian buffer zone or some kind of buffer zone so that the Syrian Kurds don't become the victims of Turkey's attack. We're going to need the Syrian Kurds to have a stable presence there. In the long run, it would be as part of a united Iraq, but a federated system where they have, you know, strong local powers there. But we need that. And when Trump just woke up one morning,
Syria. Within a united Iraq.
I meant within a united Syria. Thank you for clarifying. And you'd have a province. Iraq would be, you know, consist of different. Excuse me, Syria would consist of different provinces. In any event, I think. The way the president went about it was reckless and opened the doors to sort of unnecessary, intervention by Turkey against the Kurds. And in the case of Afghanistan, the good news is we are now negotiating with the Taliban. I mean, you're not gonna have a stable Afghanistan without a political. Settlement. So I do, again, support the idea of winding down our forces in Afghanistan. I think we need to have a plan for doing it, not just, a tweet.
And an amendment that you proposed with Senator Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, has to do with that. You're trying to require the administration to report to Congress what their intentions are and how they intend to implement a plan. But you're just not under the impression that they have any plan. And there are a number of military leaders who appear to have the same idea. I mean, Secretary Mattis has resigned, evidently, because he certainly wasn't consulted. And if he had been, he would have opposed the president's decision.
Right. Senator Toomey, Republican senator from Pennsylvania, and I proposed an amendment to the bill you and I were just discussing that deals broadly with Middle East security issues. Our amendment would have essentially required the president to come up with a plan of action. And included in that plan had to be idea of how they're going to address the issue of the Syrian Kurds, who, again, the key issue there is finishing the job against ISIS.
Speaking of Iraq, the president told Margaret Brennan yesterday on an interview on CBS that he was going to keep troops in Iraq, that he didn't have the same intentions there as he did in Syria and Afghanistan, and that was so that he could keep an eye on Iran. Washington Post reporting this morning, a guy you know pretty well, the Iraqi president Bahram Saleh, saying it doesn't work that way, and rebuffing the president's contention about that. Tell us a little bit about Saleh and how you know him and what your take is on Iraq moving forward in general, sort of irrespective for the moment of Mr. Trump's proclamations.
Sure. Well, Bahram Saleh is a Iraqi Kurd. Back in the 1980s and 90s, he was the Iraqi Kurdish representative here in Washington, D.C., here in the United States. And I got to know him quite well. I mean, he's a great person, very knowledgeable, of course, about the region that he comes from. And also very astute about sort of the general sort of security and political situation in the Middle East and around the world. And he was recently elected to be president of Iraq. Under the Iraqi constitution, they have sort of a power-sharing arrangement where the president is always somebody from from the Kurdish area. And then the prime minister and other posts are allocated some to the Sunnis, some to the Shia, to ensure, again, a power-sharing arrangement among the very biggest factions in Iraq. And the key to Iraq's future is to be able to hold these groups together because one of the things that happened during the Iraq War, which I very much opposed, was we sort of took the lid off Pandora's box and unleashed all these sectarian forces. So you, of course, had the Sunnis were fighting against the Shia, and the Kurds were sort of trying to protect their area. And Iraq is still obviously in a very sort of precarious situation. So the the purpose for our troops being there for now are to provide some stability, sort of as a broker among these different factions to try to keep the glue on Iraq. So it
and are we the best entity to do that?
Well, we are for now, but not forever. I mean, obviously the goal is to ensure that these different factions can live together and govern a united Iraq that also respects the differences among different groups of people in different regions. And the other purpose of our forces there, of course, is to make sure ISIS doesn't come back. After all, ISIS took over Mosul and some of these very big Iraqi towns a number of years ago, and we helped push them out. And so we still have that mission in Iraq. But the reason President Trump's comments, drew this rebuke from the current president of Iraq is Iraq has worked to try to develop good relations with their neighbor, Iran.
Hasn't always been the case, of course, but you think those relations are improving?
Well, it has definitely not always been the case. They fought a long war against each other in the late 1980s, and as part of that war, actually, Saddam Hussein, almost wiped out the Kurds. But if you remember, Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator, and he was he's a Sunni, and the Sunnis are the minority within Iraq. The Shia are the majority within Iraq. So Saddam Hussein held on to power largely through intimidation and force. And when that lid was taken off, of course, you had the great civil war and the war that followed. And it meant that the majority Shia in Iraq were able to establish stronger relations with the majority Shia country of neighboring Iran. And so they took bitter enemies who fought a war against each other and now have more of they're not bitter enemies at this point in time. And so when President Trump says publicly that the reason U.S. forces are in Iraq is to keep an eye on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a lot of problems for the Iraqi government, including the Shia in that government, who are trying to have at least a working relationship with their neighbors in Iran. And I should point out that a lot of the Shia in Iraq received a lot of support from their fellow Shia in Iran. So, again, President Trump just unnecessarily stirred the pot in a counterproductive way.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. My guest for the hour is Senator Chris Van Hollen. We'll have more with Senator Van Hollen when we return from a quick break. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can also check us out on the WYPR Facebook page. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to be taking up two different topics. We're first going to discuss how African Americans are depicted in horror movies. Tananari Vidu is the producer of a new documentary film called Horror Noir, and she'll join us. We're also going to talk about the popularity of faith-based stories on TV. shows like the new hit God Friended Me. So we'll talk about all that tomorrow with Sherry Parks on the Midday Culture Connections. Hope you can join us. If you're just tuning in today, my guest is Senator Chris Van Hollen. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. You can join me on Twitter at @TomHallWIPR. And you can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. Senator, let's talk a little bit more about some national security issues that you've been involved in. We had a really disconcerting set of incidents last week when the directors of the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence, Gina Haspel and Dan Coats, testified before the Senate Intel Committee. You don't sit on that committee, but afterwards, the president tweeted that his intel chiefs were naive and wrong and needed to go back to school. And they did outline a number of really very clear and present threats to our national security, having to do with Iran, having to do with China, having to do with Russia, having to do with cybersecurity and other matters. We have this piece in Time magazine that was posted on Saturday. Multiple people who've been involved in briefing the president, one called a willful ignorance on the part of the president to ignore and just, you know, dismiss assessments by the intelligence community. What is your understanding of the assessment from, you know, people like Mr. Coats and Ms. Haspel, and what is the Senate to do about the president's apparent unwillingness to believe what he's told?
Well, this is very alarming. It's not new from this president, but that just indicates that he doesn't seem to be adapting to a very important part of the job. You know, intelligence information and facts are not partisan. You don't have Republican intelligence facts or Republican or Democratic. I mean, they call the shots as they see them. These are professionals who look at the data every day. They come up with non-political reports assessing various threats. And in this case, you've got them testifying before Congress with their findings, and the President of the United States dismissing their assessments. It reminded me again of what happened at Helsinki when, you know, President Trump sided with President Putin on the question about whether or not the Russians had interfered in the 2016 elections, and essentially said, I'm going to take, you know, Vladimir Putin's word for it. These are big gaps between the president's sort of assessment of the world and the threats we face and the reality as reported by our intelligence agencies. So if you think about this in the context of American national security, as we should, obviously it's very troublesome because you want a reality-based president, not one who tries to make up his own facts. Now, it is true that the Intelligence Committee has gotten it wrong before, obviously, on certain things.
He mentions, you know, weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein in particular.
They certainly got it wrong in a big way that time, although my view, if you go back and look at the details, is a lot of what happened was political interference by the Bush administration and specifically Vice President Cheney, who essentially cook the interpretation coming out of the CIA. There were people like a fellow by the name of Paul Pillar who called it right, but a lot of the people who called it right were dismissed. And that was the real abuse in that administration was the politicization of intelligence information. So this is obviously very disturbing when the President of the United States on issues like the strength of ISIS or the, you know, what the Russians are up to is in a very different universe than the facts indicate.
One of the things that they cautioned about is that China and Russia are more aligned than at any point since the mid-1950s, meaning that it's not like we have these two separate problems, Russia and China. We have an allegiance and alliance being developed between those two countries. Are we at all prepared for the reality of the geopolitical exigencies at this moment?
Well, one of the real risks here of the way Trump is pursuing foreign policy is it's driving our adversaries together. And of course, Russia and China have been adversaries of one another, but he is driving them together. And when you put them together in trying to push back against United States national security interests, obviously that harms our own efforts. And so it is very disturbing to see that the consequences of, one of the consequences of President Trump's policy is to drive Russia and China closer together, both making common cause to undermine U.S. interests around the world.
My guest for the afternoon is Senator Chris Van Hollen here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. We are streaming our conversation live. Senator, we have an email from Naomi having to do with the shutdown. Of course, that affects many of your constituents because so many folks here in Maryland are members, of the federal government workforce. Naomi says, I was not at all impressed with Speaker Pelosi's handling of the shutdown because her behavior simply reinforced this idea that it's a winner/loser game. I personally have nothing against President Trump having a win on the wall if it means we can defuse the wall as a symbol and take this moment to come together as a country. What is the takeaway? What is the lesson that we learned after the 35 days of the shutdown? And what are you anticipating may happen on the 15th of February when the current continuing resolution expires?
Well, I hope one of the lessons that's been learned is that shutting down the government is never a good, smart tool for trying to negotiate differences on policy issues. It created a huge amount of disruption and pain throughout the country. Obviously, within Maryland and Virginia and District of Columbia, a disproportionate amount of pain because of the federal workforce in this area. And, back in December, President Trump said he would be, quote, proud. That's his word, not mine. Proud to shut down the government if he didn't get things 100% his way. Well, there's nothing to be proud of when it comes to disrupting the public, making 800,000 federal employees go without pay, and the damage done to service contract workers and others who provide often thankless but important support for the U.S. government. I mean, think about janitorial services and cafeteria services, as well as a lot of small businesses in Baltimore and elsewhere. Senator Cardin and I met with small businesses here in Maryland who were not able to get Small Business Administration loans, and it was hurting their operations.
Can we avoid it again in 11 days?
So, well, I certainly hope so. Senator Cardin and I were both part of a bipartisan group in the Senate that called for this timeout, this three-week timeout. I would have liked to, have a full year plan. Don't get me wrong. That was what we really pushed for. But we couldn't get that through the Senate. So we were part of a bipartisan group that offered an amendment a number of weeks ago to open the government for this three-week period of time to try to reach a resolution. And fortunately, the president did adopt that approach. Now, the key, of course, is to keep the government open, and there's an ongoing negotiation discussion to try to accomplish that. I hope it's successful. I should say that with respect to that discussion, there's no debate about the need for border security. We need secure borders. We don't want open borders, but we need to do it in a smart and effective way. And that's what this negotiation will be about, in addition to other immigration things and other priorities.
Senator Portman, I believe, of Ohio has suggested a bill or proposed a bill that would make it essentially illegal to shut down the government. Is there any steam gathering around that idea?
So I support putting that provision, it's called the End Government Shutdowns provision, in place on a trial basis for 2 years because we've seen the havoc and damage caused by this record-long 35-day shutdown. So I support putting that in place for a limited period of time. Now, you might reasonably ask, why not put a provision like that in forever, right, to prevent government shutdowns? And the answer is that it creates real problems within the overall budget process. What it does essentially is put the U.S. budget on autopilot, and it makes it harder for the country to respond to new priorities. Meaning, if you had a determined group in the Senate, or the, you know, especially in the Senate, that wanted to disrupt the budget process, they would have the power to prevent any president or the Congress from taking on new national priorities and initiatives. Because under that proposal, when there's a dispute about keeping the government open, you go to automatic pilot. And so over a long period of time, that could be very harmful to the country. So I'm in favor of putting this in place for 2 years, maybe 3 years, as we get through this very rocky period.
Another question about the wall from a listener in Waverly. Herman, welcome to Midday with Senator Chris Van Hollen.
Hello, Senator.
Hi.
It seems to me that our ambassadors to Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador are AWOL. We don't hear from them. Why doesn't Congress call them home to testify on what's going on in their countries to cause the citizens to flee north? And what can we do beside building walls? What can we do about it beside building walls?
All right. Well, thanks for that question, Herman. Of course, the joint committee that's working on a solution to this is, as we understand it, consulting experts about what the best way to implement a border security plan is. Does it include members of the administration and the ambassadorial corps as well?
Well, I agree with the caller that in addition to looking at ways that we can most effectively secure our border, we should also look to some of the root causes of people coming north from mostly Central American countries, where you have a whole lot of civil strife and you've got people, in many cases, fleeing for their lives from gangs or other activities. And so to the extent that we, together with some of our partners in the region, can provide more stability in these countries, obviously that limits the incentives for people to come to the United States. And so part of this discussion is what can we do to better address some of the issues in these countries that produce these migrations. Again, I should point out that, you know, these migrations have happened for a period of time. We need to address them. But the notion that we've got some kind of huge invasion that requires U.S. military deployments to the border, in my view, is a scare tactic that the president has been using. So yes to border security. And I think people need to know that we have, on a bipartisan basis, provided the resources to do that. I mean, people may be surprised to learn we already have 700 miles of barriers along the border. In addition to that, we have border security patrols. We have other technology. And so let's try and take this out of the political realm and talk about this with the experts. And that's what many of us have tried to do.
Yeah, of course, we should also recall that when it comes to diplomatic input and solutions, the State Department is vastly understaffed. The staff that handles Latin America, Central America, and these kinds of immigration issues, they haven't been hired. And there are people in acting capacities and stuff. So that's another
issue. This is a huge, huge problem. You know, this administration early on essentially imposed two things. They imposed a hiring freeze at the State Department, and then they did not nominate ambassadors for a very, very long time. And so you do have these big holes. We're trying to catch up on that effort. There have been the Congress has approved a number of nominations to some ambassadorial spots, but there's still big holes.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Senator Chris Van Hollen. We'll have more with the senator when we return after a break. Our number at Midday is 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we take a quick break, on Mondays here on our program, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost
lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City during the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 18 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides and the victim identifications that are posted on the Baltimore City Police Department's Facebook page. So far this year, 28 people in our city have lost their lives to violence. This past weekend was a Baltimore ceasefire weekend. We check in with one of the ceasefire's founders, Erica Bridgeford, following every ceasefire weekend. Erica will be here Wednesday on Midday. Police reported two homicides this weekend. The names of those victims have not yet been released. In the 6 days prior to the ceasefire weekend, Baltimore police reported three homicides in our city. So far, two of them have been identified. Their names are Tommy Graham Jr., age 54, and Calvin Gilbert. He was 25 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Senator Chris Van Hollen. Senator Van Hollen serves on the Senate Budget Committee as well as the Banking and Environment Committees and the all-important Appropriations Committee. He's also the former chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. President Trump will give a State of the Union address tomorrow night at 9 o'clock as negotiations continue over his insistence on a border wall. Stacey Abrams, the former candidate for governor in Georgia, will give the Democratic response. WYPR will carry both of those speeches live, and we'll talk about them Wednesday here on Midday with Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute. If you'd like to join us today and pose a question to Senator Van Hollen, our number is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Senator, we have a tweet from Jeff who says, money driving politics is arguably the overarching problem we face today, whether through campaign dollars or lobbying legislators. Please tell us what you're doing to fight that.
I agree with the tweeter that this is at the core of a lot of problems that we've got in the Congress and with our politics. And I am very much in favor of the what's called House Bill 1. This is the new Democratic House majority is
proposed by
John Sarbanes.
John Sarbanes, our congressman.
Exactly. I was just with John and Elijah Cummings, Senator Cardin, this morning at Baltimore City Community College on some education issues, and we talked about this bill. This bill is a sort of political and electoral reform piece of legislation. It has lots of components, but on this issue, it would put in place a strong system to incentivize lower dollar contributions from a broader base of people. And it would also include something that I championed in the House and still in a leading on in the Senate for disclosure. So get rid of the secret money in politics. Voters have a right to know who is spending gobs of money to try to elect different candidates. When I was in the House, we actually passed it out of the House. It got 59 votes in the United States Senate. It needed to cross the 60-vote barrier to be enacted. That is also, the Disclose Act is also part of this reform package. So I am very enthusiastic about what the House of Representatives is doing. Now, Mitch McConnell has already made it clear he's going to oppose this bill, but he's got a lot of explaining to do. Why is he against transparency and disclosure and accountability? Why does he want to protect a system that relies too much on large contributions? Why does he want to support an election system that doesn't ensure that any citizen can vote, and you don't have barriers to voting. So this is going to be a major debate, and I believe the public, you know, from all political persuasions, believes that democracy works best when we have more people participating rather than when we try and create barriers to participation.
And I think a lot of people applaud that effort and the effort of Congressman Sarbanes. On the other hand, you're a realist, and as the now former chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, it was your business to make sure that people running for office had enough money and had the kind of money that could give viable campaigns, you know, produce viable campaigns. And in fact, in an election cycle here in the midterms where a Congress picked up 40 seats, the Senate did not do as well. I mean, we have a Heidi Heitkamp and a Joe Donnelly, those types losing, you know, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, losing their seats, which does that indicate to you that, you know, the president's support, perhaps here in the bubble of Maryland and the bubble of the East Coast or in the bubble on the West Coast, is being underestimated, and that, I mean, Mr. Trump stumped for all three of the Republican senators who won those races, and he was successful.
Well, I don't. So there's no doubt that Donald Trump, President Trump, is popular in some of the reddest states around the country, including a place like North Dakota, where, as you said, Heidi Heitkamp was defeated. But remember, in the last Senate cycle, we had 27 Democratic senators who were up for reelection, including 10 of them from states that Donald Trump had won. We had only 8 Republicans up for re-election, Republican senators, and only one of them was from a state that Hillary Clinton won, Nevada, and that Republican senator lost. Whereas when you look at the Republican states, in fact, you had Democrats winning in 7 of those states that Donald Trump won. The purple Midwest states, as well as states like West Virginia and Montana, where both Manchin and Tester were re-elected, and a pickup of Arizona, which had voted for President Trump.
And so, the 2020 map looks very different.
And it's a very different map. So I would actually, if you actually want to see what the impact of Donald Trump was on these elections, it is not, you wouldn't look at the reddest of red states that he won and say, well, you know, the Republicans won in a few of those. That was actually expected that they would pick up in some of those states. But you would look at the House of Representatives, for example, and see a major watershed election where a lot of Republicans, especially from suburban areas, were washed out.
Ralph Northam in Virginia, the now very much embattled governor of that state, was said to be meeting with advisors over the weekend. And again, this morning, at least by the time we went on the air about 50 minutes ago, he had not announced his intention to resign. You have encouraged him to do so. What does this situation with Governor Northam mean for the Democratic Party writ large, for the brand of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the governor should resign. I think his conduct was unacceptable, and his changing explanations totally inadequate. And I would say it's not just a question of what's important for the Democratic Party. It's important for what the country stands for. We need to continue our journey to build a more perfect union. We need to continue our journey where we say it's unacceptable that, you know, people engage in, you know, this racist kind of conduct. And one clear way to do that would be for the Democrats. But I think, you know, I think this is what the response should be whenever we encounter this kind of situation, making it clear that that kind of conduct is unacceptable.
Let's go to the phones to Moshe in Baltimore, who has a comment about Governor Northam. Moshe, welcome to the program with Senator Van Hollen.
Hi. I'd like to make 2 brief comments. I'll be honest with you. I don't do well speaking on the phone, you know, the pressure and the hyperventilation, so I apologize for that, but I'll keep it brief to satisfy that. First of all, the issue of the governor, and second of all, a brief comment about the issue of the wall and the shutdown. The issue of the governor, I'm very distressed by this spiraling, just accelerating spiral of basically opportunities to be offended, and the media is pandering to this hypersensitivity. Please don't misunderstand. I'm a member of a minority group that has suffered discrimination also.
Did you find the pictures of Governor Northam, that were taken when he was in medical school offensive?
I'll be honest with you. I've not followed the story closely. I've not seen the pictures. I'm really mostly getting my news from my wife.
You should take a look at the pictures, Moshe. Yeah, and let's have you make another quick comment, and then we'll turn it back to the Senate.
But just follow on that comment, and that is there are many elements, and especially in the entertainment industry, that are getting a pass for being ongoing, offensive, confrontational, nasty. And I don't get why the entertainment industry gets a pass. And what took place in someone's many years ago.
All right, take it, because we're talking about unspecific things. But another real quick comment, and then we need to move on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and kind of just the issue with the wall briefly?
Very briefly, yes, sir.
Very briefly. To me, I don't get it. The system is broken. It's not a matter of the Republicans or the Democrats. Not a matter of the branches. The problem is the branch. This has been going on for a long time. The fact that if the budget is not approved, that the whole government comes to a shutdown, that's more of the problem. I'm saying you have to negotiate. But there's something in the system that allows this to happen. It's not Trump shutdown. It's not the Democrats. It's not the Republicans. The system itself needs to be fixed.
And all right. Well, thanks for the call. So, Senator, I mean, is this system that we have of continuing resolutions to fund the government, not the entire government didn't shut down because several of the agencies were funded adequately and in time. But there were, several that were not. And that led to the problem that we had.
Well, I think it should be very clear to everybody that first of all, as you said, Tom, we funded a number of departments, but you had 9 departments that were shut down as part of this partial government shutdown. 8 of them have nothing to do with the Department of Homeland Security. And yet there was bipartisan agreement from the House and the Senate for fully funding those for the whole year. And so the obvious question, and the one that Senator Cardin and I repeatedly called upon Mitch McConnell to adopt, was let's vote on the budgets to open the 8 of the 9 federal departments that have nothing to do with Homeland Security and where there's already bipartisan agreement. Why hold them hostage to a dispute over one part of the Department of Homeland Security budget? That is what is unacceptable. And that is what President Trump did. He is the one who said he's going to shut down those 8 departments that have nothing to do with Department of Homeland Security in order to try to, get his way, 100% his way on the wall. So I agree with the caller. We should not have government shutdowns. And the way to do it is just to not hold up the entire government when you don't get your way on one piece of one department.
So we're running out of time. I'm not going to have a chance to get to a couple of callers, but I know what their questions are. One of them concerns Joe Biden and his consideration of running for president. We now have, I think, 10, if my count is right, Democratic candidates for president. Have you endorsed anybody, or do you intend to endorse anybody anytime soon?
I have not endorsed anybody, and as to the future, I don't know. I think we've got lots of really good candidates that are in this race for the nomination. My view is—
Are you going to be one of them?
I am not going to be running president, but I am going to be going to different places around the country, laying out what I believe is an important Democratic Party agenda, really an important American agenda. I would urge all of the candidates to follow the example of Kamala Harris and move their headquarters to Baltimore.
Yes. Well, Senator, it's always good to see you, and I appreciate your time and look forward to the next opportunity.
Good to be with you. Thanks, Tom.
Senator Chris Van Hollen, that is it for us today. Coming up on the program tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We'll be discussing Horror Noir. It's a new documentary that explores the history of representations of black folks in horror movies. Plus, we'll talk about the enduring popularity of faith-based stories on television. Sherry Parks joins me tomorrow for Midday Culture Connections, and hope you can join us as well. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall, here and now, coming up after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.